Welcome back to Warning Shots here on CKUW 95.9 FM. On the line with us, we have Sakura Saunders from Protest Barrack and the Prometheus Radio Project, and there's a whole bunch of other things on here that we get to describe her as. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Haven't seen you in a while, but it's nice to connect over the phone line at least. So we're going to talk today about some of the problems surrounding gold mining and how it's being resisted. So for the listeners, I think I'd like to just jump right in and ask you, why is mining so devastating to the communities you work with? And can you tell me of a story of how community lives have changed due to the influx of mining in their territories?
Okay, well, I just want to start out by saying that, you know, most of the communities I work with, you know, are actually protesting specifically gold mining. And I also work with some communities that are resisting uranium, and then, you know, a couple that are resisting other types of mining. But let me just start with gold. Largely because of the price of gold and also because gold is so rare, you don't find it in, you know, like, rivers for panning and things like that in any large quantities anymore. In fact, gold averages about one part per million gold per waste. And that's even within what they consider gold ore. So all of that waste is ground up into a powder fine consistency and drenched in cyanide solution in order to extract that microscopic gold from the ore. And of course, this is going to cause enormous amounts of environmental problems. I mean, you know, it's not just the volume of the waste. You don't find gold amongst benign ore bodies. They're typically found amongst sulfide ore bodies with lots of lead and arsenic and cadmium and selenium and sometimes even mercury. So the toxic metals that gold is buried with, alongside just the mere volume of the waste and the amount of water that it takes to leach the gold from this waste, you're just going to have so many issues environmentally, and of course, that's going to harm the people that are right next to the mine. So you have problems of massive water depletion and dewatering of streams that villagers, you know, rely on for water and things like that. You have the massive pollution. You have the potential for accidents with cyanide. You know, this is a substance that a rice-sized amount is able to kill a person. So if that is, you know, like in its transport or in its use, if there's an accident with it and it makes its way into a waterway, well, that waterway is instantly killed.
I mean, I know a lot of people have a false perception of what even prospecting is, because you mentioned how it's not the tray form of doing it again. I was actually a gold prospector in early university. Mm-hmm. And when I told people that, that was like the immediate thing that I would get. Some of it was like for humor's sake, but people don't understand how mechanized and how destructive just the simple processes of finding out if there is gold is. And then the whole gigantic thing that you just mentioned of, oh, if there is, let's blow stuff up to get at it.
Yeah, and I mean, that's just one. I mean, I would say that, you know, one of the root causes of, like, the conflicts and the negative impacts of the community is the environmental impact. But, you know, there's this environmental impact, but then you also have a company that's coming in with a lot of money that has a singular purpose, you know, that even though mining companies act like their main goal is to develop the community, it's not. It's to mine. And they have all this money behind them, and so there's other sorts of negative consequences to communities as well, in the sense that it divides communities. You know, mining companies will come in and try to give gifts to whoever will accept gifts from them, you know. And, I mean, this is just in certain countries where, you know, they need some form of social license or the image of social license in order to operate. And so that's another one of the consequences, is just social conflict, you know, at the community level, where you have, you know, family members fighting with each other, you know, people becoming suspicious of each other about who's taking money from the mining company, who can't be trusted, and it's just extremely toxic on every level.
So I'm wondering if you might be able to very succinctly outline how much of mining of gold is really necessary and how much is superfluous or based on vanity?
Yeah, actually, I have the numbers. I've researched that quite a bit because I think that, you know, it's really absurd how much destruction is caused in the world to find gold, which is something that, you know, is the most recycled substance in the world. So the majority of gold in existence is already dug up and stored in vaults. You know, so we destroy the earth, getting it out of, like, this mountain just to put it underground and spend billions of dollars guarding it 24 hours a day so no one will steal it. It's ridiculous. But gold actually has very few practical purposes. Less than 11% of it is used for anything other than investment or jewelry, and the vast majority is used for jewelry. So you can see that, like, all the uses of gold have no real social value, and it's really just the bottom line. It's just the fact that some people are making a lot of money mining it is the only reason that it gets done, and it's very few people that are making a lot of money at it as well.
Why is so much of your activism focused on Barrick Gold specifically?
Well, Barrick is kind of a bit of a tactic. I mean, you know, to be honest, it really struck me, and lots of my, you know, my allegiances in activism are a little bit incidental. In 1 year, I ran into 3 communities that were impacted by Barrick Gold. So by the time I met the 3rd one, I kind of felt like it was a little bit of my calling, you know, to have these personal connections with people that can tell you, you know, the other side of Barrick's spin. You know, and then when I delve further, you know, so, you know, the Barrick is a target. I didn't choose Barrick. Barrick chose, or, you know, it just kind of was a coincidence, I guess. And then looking at Barrick even further, they really promote this image of corporate social responsibility. You know, they're pushing it harder than anyone else. And when you look at why they're pushing this image of corporate social responsibility, it's because they're the ones most actively undermining any sort of legislation that would cause some sort of accountability. So they're trying to regulate mercury in the United States. All of a sudden you see Barrick give hundreds of thousands of dollars to U.S. politicians, both Democrat and Republicans. You know, in Canada, we were debating Bill C-300, which would impose minimal safeguards on corporations, mining corporations operating abroad, just saying that they have to respect basic human rights and environmental, internationally recognized environmental norms. Who was the one that paid, you know, a whole squadron of lobbyists? It was Barrick Gold, time and time again, that's picked out. You know, so they have this ulterior motive of actually undermining accountability by promoting this image of them being so great. And their guards have been caught gang raping repeatedly, local people, you know, they've militarized several communities, you know, where they haven't been able to pacify the resistance. You know, they just pay armed guards. And, for example, at their North Mara mine in Tanzania, about one person a month is shot and killed. Many more are just shot and not killed. You know, so you see Barrick, you know, they're responsible for these heavily militarized, high-conflict environments, you know, so that they can mine for this unnecessary substance. And they're always spinning it. You know, they act like they deserve praise just because of the fact that they admitted to the gold, to the gang rapes, or that they admitted to the killings. They expect to be praised by civil society. It's ridiculous.
We're going to take a quick ad break, and then we'll be back to talk about the resistance to this.
Okay.
I'm going to stand until I can't stand no more if I have to stand by myself.
The American people are the last people to wake up.
Prisons are becoming an integral part of the U.S. economy.
People of color organize critical thinking, strategic work, and direct action for social, racial, gender, and economic justice.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
People of Color Organize features intersections of race, politics, feminism, movement, class, internationalism, and theory.
This is about the Black Panthers. This is about the American Indian movement. This is about all of us.
Visit us online at peopleofcolororganize.com. Follow us on Twitter at POC Organize and Facebook at facebook.com/peopleofcolororganize. You can also find us on Tumblr at peopleofcolor.tumblr.com.
We're organizing against what we term genocide.
And welcome back here to CKUW 95.9 FM. We're interviewing Sikora Saunders here on Warning Shots today. And we're going to jump right back in to this discussion of So, Sakura, how are these communities that you work with resisting the impacts and exploitation of mining companies like Barrick Gold?
Well, there's so many different strategies that they're doing. I mean, some of them are pursuing legal strategies. So, for example, in the Diego Tinos in northern Chile, I think it's an interesting case. They're an indigenous community, and they're one of the only indigenous communities that actually still has title to their land, because around the early 1900s, Chile tried to extinguish native title, and they did so by forcing all of these communities to register as agricultural communities. Well, the Diaguita were actually able to collectively buy their land and then also follow the processes, which is, you know, of an agricultural community. And these are very, like, legal processes. They have to meet once every quarter and have a president and all this kind of stuff. So the Diaguita were one of the few that were able to jump through these legalistic hoops that were meant to extinguish their native title to the land, and yet now Chile is giving their land away to foreign companies like Barrick Gold, and also they're fighting Goldcorp. So they have a lawsuit or a case against Chile and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. They also come up and expose Barrick lies every year at the shareholders meeting, you know, try building resistance here. And, of course, the main resistance is in their communities. You know, so that involves showing documentary screenings to people so that everyone knows why they should be against mining companies, doing educational sessions, doing, you know, they have an assembly process, you know, so that the entire community can actually build consensus on an alternative form of development. So they have this whole other plan that involves community tourism and everything that they've arrived at by consensus with their community. You know, for an alternative vision. So the Diaguita very much have a visionary approach, you know, providing their community and building an alternative vision outside of mining so that they can strengthen their people's resolve against the mining company. Now, when I was there very recently, you know, they want to start considering other strategies because, you know, going through these hoops, questioning the, you know, environmental impact assessment, doing the legal things, it's just buying them time, but the mine is starting construction now. So there's, you know, in serious talks about other sorts of strategies, you know, inviting leaders from other impacted communities to come and share their strategies and share their expertise so that they can see where to proceed. You know, there's other groups that are, like, for example, in Papua New Guinea, they're trying to get resettlement. And so they're, you know, just building the case, and of course, going, you know, after Barrick's lies. But unfortunately, Barrick is one of the strongest companies, and they're one of the hardest to go against. And so, like, I'm very sad to say that while, you know, Protest Barrick works with a lot of communities that are resisting, one community in Famatina was able to stop Barrick, and they did that by setting up a blockade for months. But it was when Barrick was just in their exploration phase. And there was actually another community in Pakistan, and I was actually very proud of this one because a journalist, I was working with several people there, just providing them information about Barrick and other parts of the world. And they said that they didn't, a journalist that went there told me that they said that they didn't want Barrick because they saw what Barrick was doing in Tanzania. And they knew that they didn't want Barrick to be in their community. So they actually got the province of Balochistan, which is a province that's been fighting for their independence since 1 year after Pakistan was created. Because when Pakistan was created, Balochistan was actually a separate country. And the province of Balochistan refused Barrick's mining permits, and now Barrick is seeking international arbitration to force a mine on the people of Balochistan. So that's just some examples. I feel like if I'm going to talk about mining inspiring mining resistance that's actually worked, I have to go to examples outside of Barrick, unfortunately, except for with the exception of Famatina, who set up the roadblock. But it's just because Barrick is one of the hardest companies to oppose because of their size.
I think we'd be really interested in hearing some success stories in resisting mining that are outside Barrick. So maybe one story of what's been successful.
Well, one of my favorite stories, and this is one that, you know, a lot of people have talked about, it's the community in Ecuador, in the Intag region in Junin. And basically what they did was, you know, they've been resisting mining on their land for, you know, more than 20 years. There was a Japanese company that came 20 years ago and wanted it. And they got rid of them by actually burning down the mining headquarters when no one was in camp. So they didn't hurt anybody. But they said no to the company. The company didn't listen. And so they burnt down their infrastructure. Then about 6 years ago, I want to say 6-7 years ago, there was a Canadian copper company that came in and wanted to mine on their land. And they said no. And well, this company wouldn't take no for an answer. And so they started funneling all sorts of money into local politics and trying to divide the community there. And, you know, the people, again, were saying no. And so the company actually hired a paramilitary force to intimidate the resistance. And so what the community did, and it's very, very smart, and they did it, you know, in collaboration with activists up here, is they wrote a letter to the Toronto Stock Exchange, and they said, by allowing this company to raise money on your exchange, you are endangering our lives. This company's hired a paramilitary force to intimidate us, and you are responsible for this. You know, of course, the Toronto Stock Exchange never replied to this letter, but after they wrote it, they actually got on film the paramilitary force shooting live rounds at the community and using pepper spray. So then, with their lawyers in Toronto, Klippensteins, they actually sued the Toronto Stock Exchange for $1 billion. And the lawsuit kind of went in and out of court, which is always appealed and everything. But just the threat of the lawsuit, and of course this was a small company, this is one of their, you know, only concessions was in this area. The Toronto Stock Exchange actually delisted them. And so here's a community that not only fought off the company, but they actually killed the company. They not only stopped the project, but they pretty much killed the company. And the company's trying to sue Ecuador now, you know, using those, you know, free trade agreements and, you know, various things to say that they need money, you know, to compensate for their loss of investment.
Yeah, just for our last question here in the time that we have, I was wondering if you could tell our listeners what they can do to support the efforts of these communities.
Sure. Well, there's actually a number of things people can do. There's what I think is really needed right now is there's a ton of like amazing documentaries and things like that, and people really need to build awareness. Like if you have 15, 20, 30 friends that you can get in a room to listen to these things, I highly recommend that you do show them movies such as Tomo Grande or Under Rich Earth or The Business of Gold in Guatemala. You know, there's actually so many of these various movies that you can show to build awareness. There's, you know, I think that people should be looking for mining companies that are based close to where they are, and they should be protesting it. And they should also be supporting local First Nations communities that are also fighting extraction. So there's, you know, the Washogeg First Nation is fighting extraction. There's Shoal Lake that's fighting extraction. You know, I mean, if the situation abroad and at home is very, very, very similar. It's the same groups that are being targeted. And we need to build a culture that respects a community's right to say no. And if we do, if we're able to do that at home, then it's a much easier argument and a much easier case to win for communities abroad. And we have to be spreading this awareness. And then finally, there's a really actually great bill. You know, and I don't usually recommend electoral reforms, but this one would actually allow communities to sue within Canadian courts. And so this would actually, you know, allow the communities that are directly impacted to have more agency in fighting off these companies. But what stage we are right now, because I think a lot of people still don't understand the nature of these conflicts, is really to like be building awareness and be building solidarity with local Indigenous communities and linking their struggles to these struggles abroad. You know, and then, you know, once we start building a larger culture of resistance, then we'll see these success stories become more and more frequent.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today and letting our listeners get a little more information on what's going on with gold mining. And I'm sure we'll have you back on soon as we'd like to have community updates on what's going on as we go forward.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
All right, take care.
Okay,
thank
you too. Bye.